It's awfully easy to blame other people for our problems. Thomas Merton talks about the key reason why we fail to experience the abundant life of Jesus Christ. He says, It is not that someone else is preventing you from living happily. You yourself do not know what you want. Rather than admit this and ask for God's help, you pretend that someone else is keeping you from exercising your liberty. Who is this? It's you, yourself. If you want to enjoy the good life that Jesus has promised us, then stop blaming other people for your struggles. If you want to experience God's favor in life, then follow the path that God teaches us all in the Bible. If you want God's attention, follow God's prescription. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10 this morning. He has just said, verse 9, you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing, God's goodness. And then he says, because for the one who desires life to love and see good days, to anyone who wants the good life, loves life, wants to see good days. Now drop down to verse 12. For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. He pays attention to you, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Peter talks about those who desire the good life in verse 10. And he talks about how God pays attention to, in a good way, we don't want God paying attention to us in a bad way, we want it in a good way. The person God pays attention to is the one who follows his instructions, lives righteously in verse 12. In between the first half of verse 10 and verse 12 is God's prescription for a life well lived. And we find three commands here that God gives us in order to live the good life. The first command, guard your mouth from evil. Guard your mouth from evil. Now, Peter is quoting Psalm 34 here. Somebody read that in our scriptures this morning. At least the verses before the ones that Peter is quoting from. Psalm 34 is poetry. And Hebrew poetry was constructed according to parallelism of thought, not rhyming, like we have in our poetry. There are three couplets in these verses, and each couplet contains a parallelism, and all three are commands. They are not options. The other thing we must understand about Psalm 34 is its context. Psalm 34 was composed by David when he lived among the Philistines and pretended to be a lunatic, pretended to be crazy to save his life from the Philistine king, 1 Samuel 21. David's own government had turned against him. King Saul was out to kill him. So David fled to his enemies, the very people that he had fought in battle for his country. He fled to his enemies, the Philistines, for help. He took up residence among the hated Philistines. But it wasn't long before he feared for his life there too. You see, he was disobeying God. What did God have said? God said, you're the next king. I'm going to take care of you. And David didn't trust God. When his own government turned against him and they sought to kill him, he turned to the enemies of God for help. He was disobedient. He played a game of trickery, a game of deceit. He pretended to be what he was not. And that is never the pathway to God's blessing in life. Never. David knows that. And so after he pretended to be nuts and he gets away from the Philistines, he composed this psalm to express the lessons he learned from his failure of faith. And the first command is in verse 10. The one who wants to live the good life must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Think David knew that? He just experienced that. He'd just done all that. Now, it's synonymous parallelism, with so each phrase isn't intended to say something different. It's intended to say the same thing as the other phrase. Literally, we must stop our tongue from speaking bad words and stop our lips from speaking trickery. We are to be men and women of integrity. And the first place that our integrity will be tested is with our words, with our mouths. How we speak, what we say, is the first test of our integrity. Christians should be known as a people who speak the truth. We should be absolutely trustworthy. If we give our word, others should know they can trust it. We must not deceive or trick people for our own benefit. Paul commands us, Colossians 3:9, not to lie, and to always speak the truth to one another, Ephesians 4:25. Words. Now Jesus said, the mouth speaks out of that which fills the heart. So, if our hearts are filled with anger and bitterness, then it's not a surprise that anger and bitterness come out of our mouths. If our mouths spew bad words, then we can tell that our minds are evil too. The mouth simply expresses whatever is inside the heart, the mind, the inner person. If we gossip about others, it's because our minds are bent toward gossip. If we speak hurtful words and destroy other people, it is because our hearts are filled with sin. It's us. It's our responsibility. So Christians have to exercise self-control and not let our mouths spew hurtful words. Self-control, by the way, is one of the fruit of the Spirit. Should exemplify us. And words do hurt. You know they hurt. I know they hurt. We've all been hurt by words. Words damage. Words are destructive. What we say about each other can destroy each other. James wrote, you're familiar with the words, of course. James wrote, see how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire, and the tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. The tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the entire body and sets on fire the course of our life and is set on fire by hell. That's our tongues. And oh, the damage they do. A crew from the TV show Mythbusters was staging an experiment in the town of Dublin, California. They were trying to fire a cannonball into some large water containers at a bomb disposal range. Unfortunately, the Mythbusters crew seriously underestimated the power of this cannonball. According to a newspaper report, the cantaloupe-sized cannonball missed the water, tore through a cinder block wall, skipped off a hillside, and flew some 700 yards east. But it didn't end the damage. The cannonball bounced in front of a home on a quiet street, ripped through the front door, raced up the stairs, blasted through the bedroom, exited the house, leaving a perfectly round hole in the stucco, crossed 6-lane Tessajera Road, took out several tiles from the roof of a home on Bellevue Circle, and finally slammed into a family's beige Toyota minivan in a driveway on Springdale Drive. I don't know what myth they were trying to bust, but they busted a lot. Regarding the power of the stray cannonball, the owner of the minivan said, it's shocking. Anything could have happened. A spokesman for the local sheriff's department commented, crazy, 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 crazy. You wouldn't think it was possible. Our words have that kind of power. Tremendous power to rip through families, rip through churches, rip through communities, tear apart lives. Like a cannonball, they create crazy damage that you wouldn't think possible from one little comment. In all my years as a pastor, honestly, I think there are very few things as damaging as our mouths. What we say has horrible results. I've seen it destroy families. I've seen it divide churches. The tongue. Such a little member, tiny member of our bodies, but such a powerful force in our world. You know, we focus in our preaching and in our messages on all kinds of moral issues and immoral behaviors, but the most common instrument for sin is the tongue. Have you lobbed any cannonballs lately? Peter tells us that if we want to live the good life, we must guard our mouths from evil. Secondly, navigate through life carefully. Navigate through life carefully. It says in verse 10, must keep his tongue from evil, his lips from speaking evil. He must turn away from evil and do good. Verse 11. Attracting God's attention in a good way requires us to watch what we do, not just what we say. The word translated turn away from means to steer clear of something. So we're to navigate our way through life by steering clear of bad behaviors. But it's not just enough to say no to the bad behaviors. We must also say yes to the good behaviors. We're to steer clear of the bad and navigate toward doing good, Peter says. And as Christians, again, we often preach against what is wrong in our culture, in our world. We can spend so much time attacking bad behavior that people begin to equate us with what we are against. Christianity should be more about what we do than what we don't do. Christianity should be more about what we are, what we are for, than what we are against. It's not enough just to turn away from evil. We must be doing good. And every day of your life, there's choices to be made in that regard. And that is a theme of Peter in his letter. He's writing to Christians living in a culture that is antagonistic to the Christian faith. Don't forget that. And that's why it's so relevant for our lives today, in our culture today. And he stresses that the way to be an effective witness in our culture is to be known for the good works that we do for others. That's how the early church transformed that pagan, immoral, antagonistic Roman Empire. It wasn't by being against things, it was about because they were doing good, they were serving in those first few centuries. And this is Peter's theme. He's saying, Christians, you need a new model, a new mentality for how you reach your culture that is antagonistic to everything that you believe. Look back at 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 15, because this is pervading this whole section. He says in chapter 2, verse 15, "For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men." You silence the ignorance of people against our faith by doing right, by doing good. Now look at chapter 3 and verse 13. "Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good?" And drop down to verse 16. and keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. For it is better, if God should will it so, that you suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong. According to 2013 USA study, USA Today study, the share of Americans who reported feeling angry has surged from 50% in 2011 to 60% in 2013, and I suspect it's even higher today. A Harvard Medical School study from 2012 found that nearly two-thirds of all American teens admit to having anger attacks involving the destruction of property, threats toward other people, or violence, or engaging in violence. Two-thirds. Some are describing this as America's anger epidemic, says one New York News website. But here's the thing, we're not only angry, we're also afraid of one another. For four decades, reports the Associated Press, a gut-level ingredient of democracy, trust in the other fellow, has been quietly draining away. These days, only one-third of Americans say most people can be trusted. Half felt that way in 1972. The AP article concludes, 40 years later, a record high of nearly two-thirds of Americans say you can't be too careful in dealing with people. We don't trust them. Trust. Fear. American culture, and you know, all you have to do is watch the news, right? American culture is filled with two emotions, anger and fear. It's everywhere. And into this culture of fear and anger, God plops the church right in the middle of it. It's by God's intention that we're in the middle of it. We must not be a people of either anger or fear. We should be focused on doing good, because we trust God. And that's the way we're going to influence our culture, Peter says. I mean, if we simply succumb to the temptation to fight back, to retaliate against others, we're just going to become part of the anger and fear epidemic that already exists all around us. The church is supposed to be different. We will be no different than the rest of our culture. Why should they listen to us then? I hear so many Christians today, honestly, we're ending up talking a language of fear and anger most of the time. And it's damaging our witness. We need to focus on doing good for others, on serving them, on caring for their needs. We should be known not just for what we are for, not just for what we are against, but what we are for. When people see the good that we do, it will open their hearts to listen to the words that we say. But if the words that we say are so filled with fear and anger that we're losing this and we're scared of that and we're angry about this, they can't get past those words to see any good that we are doing in this world. John Marks, a producer for television 60 Minutes, so a major television program over the years, went on a two-year quest. And his quest was to investigate evangelical Christians. Now, this is a 60 Minutes producer, but he had grown up in the evangelical Christian church and rejected evangelical Christianity. He wrote a book about the quest. The book is called Reasons to Believe: One Man's Journey Among the Evangelicals and the Faith He Left Behind. He said the church's response to Hurricane Katrina turned the corner for him and became a key reason why he could then believe. One Baptist church in Baton Rouge fed 16,000 people a day for weeks. Another housed 700 homeless evacuees. Years after the hurricane and long after federal assistance had dried up, a network of churches all over America, including us, we sent mission teams there, a network of churches all over America was still sending regular teams to help rebuild houses. Most impressively to Marks, all these church efforts crossed racial lines and barriers in the Deep South. As one worker told him, we had whites, blacks, Hispanics, Vietnamese, good old Cajun. We just tried to say, hey, let's help people. This is our state. We'll let everybody else sort out that other stuff. We've got to cook some rice. Marks concludes with these words. This was his study of evangelical Christianity. He said, I would argue that this was a watershed moment in the history of American Christianity. Nothing spoke more eloquently to believers and to non-believers who were paying attention, that is, than the success of a population of believing volunteers measured against the massive and near total collapse of secular government efforts, the church. Then he said these words, the storm laid bare an unmistakable truth. Did I get the right one up here? Yeah. We're down here. The storm laid bare the unmistakable truth. More and more Christians have decided that the only way to reconquer America is through service. The faith no longer travels by the word, it moves by the deed. That's a great line from a skeptic, producer of 60 Minutes. The storm laid bare an unmistakable truth. More and more Christians have decided that the only way to reconquer America is through service. He's right. There you have it. That's Peter's message in a nutshell in the book of 1 Peter, applied to our culture today. Now we're going to be looking more closely at that in the next couple of Sundays as we continue our study of 1 Peter 3. But you see, the early church understood that concept that Peter was teaching, and they turned their world upside down, not by fighting the world, but by serving the world. Not by attacking others, but by doing good for others. It was revolutionary in the Roman world, and it is today, and it's God's call for us in America today as well. Third principle or command here, if you want to live well, seek peace with others. Seek peace with others. Peter says, he must seek peace, let him seek peace and pursue it. Peace. Peace is that state of contentment characterized by joy in our relationships with other people and with God. That state of contentment characterized by joy, well-being in our relationships with others and with God. It's the great Old Testament concept of shalom, which means peace. We think of peace kind of abstractly today. The Old Testament Hebrew thought of peace, shalom, as all of life. It was a state of well-being. We live well with one another would be shalom. And it is the very opposite of fighting with one another. Now, interestingly enough, the words for seek and pursue are very aggressive words. We don't passively hope for peace. We aggressively seek peace. We strive for peace. I don't know about you, we tend to think of fighting as something that's aggressive, that it's intense when you fight, it's aggressive. But these words are very aggressive words applied to peace. The words have the idea of hunting. A deer hunter intentionally tracks the deer in the new fallen snow, so the peacemaker is supposed to strive after peace, fight for peace in all of his relationships. Peacemaking is not passive. And I guarantee you that peacemaking is not easy, because usually you get nailed from both sides when you're trying to be a peacemaker, and it's painful. But a peacemaker is someone who looks for ways to make peace. He works at it. He strives for it. He fights for it, essentially. He hunts for peace. You say, well, yeah, that's great, Dave. But what about the authorities? What about when the authorities are totally against you and they're trying to kill you, or they're trying to take away all your freedoms and all your rights? What then? What then, Dave? Well, Peter is addressing that exact scenario here. Don't take it out of its context. That is exactly what was happening to all of the people Peter was writing to. And furthermore, he quotes from Psalm 34, which was David, and that's exactly what was happening to David. Here was David. He'd been a loyal leader in his own country. He'd fought for his own country. And now his own government had turned against him and was seeking to kill him. They were hunting him down like a dog. They'd put a price on his head. Talk about having your government turn against you. And yet, you know the story of David. Not once, but twice, he spared King Saul's life. Remember that? The first time in the cave, he sneaks up and he cuts off a piece of his robe when he could have killed him. In fact, the rest of his people wanted David to kill him. Assassinate him. Get rid of this guy. He's killing people. He's leading our nation into terrible places. Kill him. David wouldn't do it. He cut off a hem of his garment. He goes out, stands on the other hill, and he calls out to King Saul, "Look what I've done." And what did Saul say? Saul said, "May the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day." Well, that's exactly what God was going to do. He was going to reward David with good. The second time that David spared Saul's life was in Saul's own army camp. David sneaked into the army camp and had the opportunity to assassinate Saul while he slept. And he refused to take matters into his own hands. Called out from a safe distance, again to show Saul, "I'm only interested in peace." Once again, Saul blessed David for his peacemaking. And God blessed David for his peacemaking. In time, God took care of the matter, and David became king. But David sought to make peace, even when his own life was in danger, even when he's hunted and persecuted. And so the words that Peter is quoting here were straight out of a life where the government and the culture had turned totally against David. And they were written to a people, Christians, that Peter was writing to in the city of Rome, where Rome had turned totally against the Christians. And it was only a few short years, as I've said, after this, that Rome began to hunt down and execute Christians, hang them, burn them at the stake, put them in the Colosseum to be killed by dogs and animals. And yet, Peter says, pursue peace, fight for it, work for it. That's the model that leads to God's blessing, even for those who persecute us. Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God." People will know that we are Christians by our peacemaking attempts. Paul wrote, "Live in peace with one another." Now, he was talking to people in the church. And if we can't live at peace with people in the church, why should the world ever listen to anything we have to say about the gospel of peace? We're to hunt for peace in every situation that God puts us. We are to pursue peace. But you and I both know that doesn't mean we'll always achieve peace. Why? This is a fallen world.
It's a sinful world.
There are times when we cannot accomplish peace, no matter how hard we try. Maybe it would require us to deny Christ or sin against God, and then, as we've talked, you can't do that. You don't pursue peace at all costs. You can't achieve peace by denying Christ or sinning. Perhaps the other person simply refuses to live in peace with us. You can't change them. Nothing you can do about it, except to do what you know you have to do. So Peter knows all of this, and he acknowledges that we might have to suffer for our faith. He's going to talk about that in the next few verses, and we might have to suffer for our faith. Peacemaking will not always be successful. And that's why I love the verse by Paul in Romans chapter 12 and verse 18. This is a great verse. If possible, so far as depends on you, be at peace with all men. Now, there aren't too many verses in the Scriptures that have more qualifiers than that. If possible, right, as far as depends on you, be at peace with everybody, not just some people. I mean, there are a lot of qualifiers in this verse, because Paul knows that some people will never be at peace with you, no matter how hard you try to be at peace with them. But insofar as you can make peace, do so. Do everything you can. And that includes people, all people, not just the nice ones. They're the easy ones to make peace with. But it's not just the nice ones, and it's not certainly not just the Christians that we're supposed to pursue peace with. It's even our persecutors. It's those who hate us that we're supposed to do everything we can to live at peace with them in our culture, in our world. The last soldier to die in World War I was an American, 23-year-old Henry Gunther, a private with the American Expeditionary Force in France. He was killed at 10:59 a.m., November 11, 1918. If you know your history, that's 1 minute, 1 minute before the armistice went into effect. Gunther's squad, part of the 79th Infantry Division, encountered a roadblock of German machine guns. Against the orders of his sergeant, who told him, "Do not attack," he charged the guns by himself with his bayonet. German soldiers, already aware of the armistice, tried to wave him off. But he wouldn't be waved off. Gunther was out for blood. He kept coming, and he was gunned down. He died instantly. His divisional record states this: almost as he fell, the gunfire died away and an appalling silence prevailed. So sad. Didn't need to die. The peace had already been won. Here was a man who would die fighting rather than enjoy the peace that had been won. But I think it's just as sad that there are some Christians who would rather die than give up fighting. Some Christians will fight to the bitter end. And here's the thing: it takes as much effort to make peace as to make war. It really does. Maybe more. We might have to think creatively. We might have to choose intentionally. But wherever possible, we should pursue peace and not fight to the bitter end. Now, we don't compromise what we know to be the truth, but we should pursue peace with everyone. On the job, when that gay rights activist tries to provoke you, seek peace, not war. Work for it. I wonder, myself, if there was another way that the clerk in Kentucky could have approached the problem of marriage licenses.
that would have kept peace and reflected the qualities of Christ in a better way.
When our political climate turns into a no-holds-barred, winner-take-all fight, is there a place for Christians to pursue peace? Think about it. Those are hard questions. And I'm not going to tell you I know the answers to all of these things in every situation. It's hard. But they are good questions to ask, that every Christian should be asking. If possible, so far as depends on you, be at peace with everyone. Wow.
Joe Stoll, pastor and former president of Moody Bible Institute, reminds us that every day there are opportunities for you, there are opportunities for me to reach out to other people to demonstrate the qualities of Jesus. We are supposed to be Christians, little Christs. And every day we have opportunities to live out those qualities in small ways. There are family members whose lives we can influence by doing good. There are non-Christians just waiting to be touched by the goodness of a Christian. Stoll suggests that we plan to commit. We intentionally get up in the morning and plan to commit an intentional act of goodness every day just to stay in shape. And he tells about an experience he had. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. He had just finished his early morning run. And as he passed by the local Starbucks, he decided to stop in and get a couple of lattes that he and his wife liked, and he would take them home to her because she'd be just getting out of bed when he got back. Since the cafe had just opened, there was only one person in line in front of him. The guy in front of him was in a major argument with the clerk. He was trying to buy the New York Times, and he was holding it up and waving it and yelling it at the clerk. And on the other hand, he was holding up a $50 bill. And he wanted to pay for the New York Times. But the problem was that the clerk had just opened the Starbucks and didn't have any change. So he couldn't sell the New York Times to this guy because he couldn't make change for a $50 bill. And so they were in this intense argument as he said, you can't buy the paper yet. I don't have change for that. And this guy's yelling, screaming, waving his $50 bill. So it occurred to Joe Stoll that this was his first chance to do something good. He stepped up to the counter and he said, "Hey, put the paper on my bill for this man. I'll buy it for him." Immediately, the tension diffused. He wanted to demonstrate the goodness and generosity of Jesus Christ in this situation. And the New York Times guy walked away saying, "Thanks a lot, all I have is yours," which didn't include the $50 bill, but, you know. To his surprise, when the barista handed him his coffee, he said, "Mister, that was a really nice thing for you to do. This world would be a lot better place to live if more people were like you." And he was kind of caught off guard. You know how these things go, and he couldn't think really of anything good to say, so he just took his lattes and left. But as he was walking down the sidewalk, he thought, "I sure blew that. I had the opportunity to point somebody to Christ in this situation. It's not the goodness of me that matters. I took credit for it." So he almost went back, but then when he turned around and looked, there was this long line back there, and he knew he couldn't get there. So, but he thought about what he would have said. He said, "I should have said this. Well, this world would not be a better place if more people were like me. It would not. But it would be a better place if more people were like Jesus, because he taught me how to do that. Point people to Christ." Now, wouldn't it be great if this week the people who know us would say that this world is a better place because we acted like Jesus in their lives. It is the testimony that others should see in us. And it's a beautiful reflection of the grace of Jesus Christ. Father, you've done so much for us, and it's easy for us to fall into fighting and attacking. It's hard to control our emotions and our words. It's hard to work for peace. It's hard sometimes to do good, even especially for those who do harm to us. But I pray that each and every one of us in this room here would pick something each day this week, something where we can do good for someone, where we can make peace with someone, where we can do something positive for someone, and that we would do so for those who have harmed us and who have hurt us, and that you would help us to be a real testimony for your grace in this world and be kind and good and peaceful this week. In Jesus' name and for your glory, not ours.